little over a week ago, during Thanksgiving weekend, on Saturday, I went someplace where I'm quite unaccustomed to going, kind of a foreign world for me. And then as I went to a very large mall, and I was amazed by the size of this mall, and some of the people I was with were amazed that I was amazed. They said, there are bigger ones. And it was many floors tall, and it's kind of like this, the inner section was this big open, you know, with terraces. You can look down and steps and stairways and escalators, and you can kind of, inside, it's like outside, right? You can see it's like people going up and down escalators and walking around in these balconies, big wide balconies, going to all the shops. But the thing that was, one of the things that struck me the most about being there was I had the feeling that everyone was very purposeful. Everyone was there for a purpose, or purposeful. I don't know if they're looking for deals, or they're looking to buy things, or I don't know why people go to the mall, but I think that's what you're supposed to do, right? Just go buy things. But the sense of purposefulness really struck me. And there was a kind of a beauty to it as well. There was something about the human capacity for having a clear sense of purpose. I don't know if they were clear in the mall, but the sense of being organized around this, a sense of purpose, a direction, this is what I'm doing, I'm here to do something, is a kind of a wonderful capacity for people, provided that that sense of purpose is used for something useful and skillful. It can be done, it can be used for harm as well. But we have a sense of, we have a possibility to live a life of purpose. So the Eightfold Path belongs to a Buddhist life of purpose. Eightfold Path gives direction to a life that we engage in purposefully, intentionally, with aspiration, motivation, with energy, and even with desire, certain desire. This is what I want to do. Set the course and engage. And some people will engage with practice very clear that they're very purposeful. This is what they're doing. This is what they're organized around. Their whole life is kind of organized or oriented. This is right. And some people are not so clear what their purpose is, and not so clear that it's the same thing what Buddhism teaches. And that's fine. But some people have other clear sense of purpose. This is what my life is about. From the point of view of, I think, for Buddhists, The Eightfold Path provides a noble purpose, a certain nobility, meaning that it has a tremendous worthiness, worthfulness, value to engage in this purposeful way, in this path. And in contrast to the sense of purposefulness in the mall, I think it's probably fair to say, is that at the mall, at least that's what nominally or kind of on the surface it's about. The purpose is to buy something. It has to do with something external. I've been told that teenagers like to go to the mall for other purposes besides shopping. But still, kind of purposeful, maybe. The Eightfold Path is not something that, first and foremost, is about getting something from the world, but rather, and looking externally for your sense of purpose and meaning, but rather finding it within oneself. Because the Eightfold Path does not exist in the real world out there. You can't go find some place in the world, you know, where they've kind of built the Eightfold Path and you can just walk on the yellow brick road and it's all good. And you can't come to IRC because we don't have the Eightfold Path here either. It doesn't exist anywhere. It exists in you. It exists in the people who walk it, who engage it. And so it involves a different orientation than the usual orientation in the mall. It involves an orientation not to acquire, not focus for our happiness and well-being in the external world, but rather to bring a careful attention and care, love, for here. Andrea last night talked about a journey to here. And here, to really bring it home, home in our hearts, home in our minds, home in this body, to find it here. Here's where the path is found. And and that's a huge, for some people, a huge sea change to go from, you know, the world outside, the wanting and messages and adjusting and fitting into the world, to really turning in and beginning to study and learn what is really going on in here. What's making me tick? What makes me operate? What are the values? What are the orientations? What are the beliefs? What are the emotional drives that are behind the way that I organize my life, that provides my life with some sense of purpose or direction or responsiveness to what goes on? And I believe it's probably fair to say that everyone or near everyone has some sense of purpose in their life, though it might not be conscious. And some of them are not so noble. Some people's purpose perhaps is to watch as much TV as you can. I have a teenage son who likes to watch TV, and he does that with a real sense of purpose at times. And when I was a teenager, I had a very clear sense of purpose when I went through the whole telephone book to find people who lived in a certain street. And then I called the people who lived in that street to ask if she was there. Because I knew her name, I knew the street she lived on. That's all I knew. So, you know, that took, I didn't have to do a lot. I went from one direction of the telephone book. My friend went in the other direction looking for we called all the numbers in that street until we found her. That takes purpose. So, you know, we have purpose. We have things. And they say that people have no purpose or no desires are probably depressed. I wonder if that's even true, though, because sometimes depression, there's many causes for depression, but sometimes depression comes from maybe frustrated purpose, frustrated desire that has not really been understood and worked with in a deep way. So the Eightfold Path can be seen as one of the primary ways in which the Buddha organized a life of purpose. And in order to understand what that purposeful life is, it begins with right view. And the word for view in Pali, ancient language, has the same double meaning as the English word view. The word is ditti, and it means both a kind of a world view, a kind of an understanding, a perspective, an orientation, an understanding that a person has, but it also means to see, to see deeply into what's going on. And I think that it's not a coincidence that both meanings are implied because of the tremendous emphasis in Buddhism in coming to a place where we see directly for ourselves. Not to have a learned belief, learned teaching that stays only learned, but to have it provisionally so that it gets us to able to see clearly for ourselves. And it also points to that, again, to we're looking back at our experience, looking at what we can actually experience. To see is something you do in the present moment. So it's not something abstract. And that's one of the beauties of the right view in Buddhism. It doesn't really require metaphysical, supernatural beliefs, beliefs in a hereafter or a there before, I guess, that's what we say. There before, hereafter. So it involves an understanding or a perspective. And I like the word orientation because it orients us to the path. It helps us to find the path. Some people use the idea of a framework. It's a frame of reference that helps us to understand something. It's not meant to be kind of like a new reality. It's mostly a way of looking at the reality we're in, a useful way of looking. And so before I tell you what right view is in Buddhism, I think it's worthwhile for each of you to consider. Maybe, I don't know if you want to do it while during the talk, but maybe while you're here today, is to give some deeper consideration to the views that you carry with you. What are the primary beliefs, understandings about life, yourself? What's the orientations, perspectives you bring to bear on your life and what goes on? And some of those views that people carry with them are very conscious and clearly adopted and learned, and some of them are subconscious that we carry with them. We don't really understand initially what they might be. So, for example, what people don't understand sometimes is people who live ordinary lives that are not very introspective and not very quiet. There's a lot of chatter in the mind. They don't really see some of the deeper currents of what they believe or what they motivate or their attitudes they have. And a fairly common one for teachers to hear about on retreat after some days is, you know, every once in a while someone will come and say, with their eyes kind of wide open, kind of in amazement, and say, "I had no idea how pervasive fear is in my life. That is everything I think, everything I do, it turns out, is somehow rooted in having anxiety." And I was always so busy doing things, and many times things seemed just fine. But when I got really quiet, I could see there was this little root, a little kind of underneath it, a little movement of fear that was insecurity, that was kind of everywhere. And so when I go into a room of people, I look at the room through the filter of my fear. Where is the danger here? How do I make myself safe? So that's an orientation of fear and the search for security. I've known people who've done the opposite, in a sense, where they've come and said, "Wow." I like it when people go, "Wow," as opposed to, "Oh no." "Wow. It's amazing. I didn't realize how I knew I have a tendency to be aversive, but I didn't know how pervasive that was." And so this being aversive to everything, going into a room, it isn't to look for how to be safe, but rather to look what's wrong. What's wrong out there, you know? And that, so that's the tendency, strong tendency. That's an orientation. That's a view, kind of a view, a way of viewing the situation through some deep attitude that we carry with us. And some of that maybe has to do with personality and who, you know, there's different kinds of personalities. It's not wrong to be this way, but it's useful to see how pervasive it can be. And even if it comes from our personality, some people have more of a desire personality, some maybe a fear personality, some aversive personality. The regular practice of an attitude, the regular practice of a view conditions us, predisposes us to continue to see that way until it gets locked in a very deep way. And there are other views that we carry with us. Some are learned from childhood or from life experience. When I was in junior high school and high school, I had a group of friends that seemed to me like whenever I talked to them, and I said something more than a sentence long, I would lose their interest. And they would want to go off and do something else. And I developed this idea that I had nothing interesting and important and relevant to say. So that's why I got this profession. Since so I can monopolize the audience. I developed this kind of, it wasn't a very good feeling, kind of a negative self-view about myself based on how my friends treated me, and I carried that with me. And I could, probably each of you has your own history of ways you were treated by the world around you or something. People laughed at you and when you were at a tender age and something closed up and a view that you can't share that anymore. We inherit all these ideas of what we should and shouldn't do from our society, our religions of upbringing, our family. You shouldn't be this way. That's a view. I should be this way, and I'm supposed to be that way, but I'm not that way. And so we're holding ourselves against standards that we try to shoehorn ourselves into. And then when we can't, then we can feel bad about ourselves. And that's another view. I'm wrong. I'm a bad person. I know someone who, it seems like a regular statement, is I'm a bad person. Kind of heartbreaking to hear that someone even use that kind of language. But it's a view that we have. And then there's views about what we need. I need to have certain things. I need to have, you can go through your list, you can fill in the blank. That's a view. Maybe you need it, maybe you don't. One of the wonderful things about living a very simple life for a while, going backpacking or sometimes staying in a more renunciant monastery than we have here, is to appreciate how you can still be alive and happy with very little. You don't need to have TV or the computer. I'm hoping some of you will learn that really well this week, that how wonderful it is to have a week without a computer. You'll survive. So this idea of need. So one of the things that begins happening in this kind of practice we're doing here, especially in the silence of a many-day retreat, and doing mindfulness, which mindfulness, again, is just turning into here. What's our experience? What's going on here? Is we start noticing that things are not going well. That we're feeling a little bit off, uneasy about something, disappointed, discouraged. There's a whole kind of sad or somehow something's beginning going. And in Buddhism, this is considered to be a kind of a good thing, provided you look at your, we like the word suffering a lot, look at your suffering through a particular perspective. If you look at your so-called suffering through some of the old perspectives, it's very easy to just make things worse. I'm suffering, and must be because I am doing something wrong and I'm a bad person. I'm suffering, and means the other people are doing something wrong and they're bad people. That's just a very simple way of saying it, but we have, we interpret our experience through particular viewpoints. What makes suffering noble, or the suffering of the noble ones, is not, I say this not to justify suffering or say you should suffer better, but what we do in Buddhism is we bring a view, right view, an orientation to look upon our experience that's different maybe than how we usually do. And it's meant to be a very hopeful or positive or encouraging perspective. And we bring up a perspective that points us to the fact, the possibility of becoming free of that suffering, free of the disappointment, free of the feeling of unease, free of the discouragement or despair, whatever you might be feeling. And so that's kind of the right view, is to bring that orientation in our life that leads to a kind of happiness that is different than the happiness you get from getting a big discount at the mall. A different kind of happiness than getting things of the world. Different kind of happiness than finally being able to reach her through the telephone book. There is a kind of happiness in those things, but those kinds of happiness in Buddhism are considered to be unsatisfactory for lasting happiness. So in terms of the girl, when I was 14, I think I was 14 then, I was finally able to reach her. I don't remember her name anymore now. I remember the story, but I don't remember her name. It didn't. Something about it didn't last. It was so important at the time, right? But it didn't provide me with lasting happiness. Lasting humor. Amusement in myself. So, right view, the beginning of the path, is a perspective, a view, which helps us to find the path, helps us to show us where the path is found. And there's a number of two primary aspects of this right view that I think are particularly important for people who practice. One is that our actions make a difference, that what we do has consequences, and we can act differently. It seems like a very ordinary thing that, it's something we all know and do. If you have a thorn in your foot, most of us don't just continue walking with a thorn in the foot, letting it go deeper and deeper. We have confidence and faith that it's possible to sit down and take your shoe off and hopefully pull the thorn out. And then, it'll feel better. That our actions have consequences. We can act in a way that's beneficial. The Four Noble, right view entails that for our inner life, our psychological life, or our spiritual life, that for our psychological well-being, psychological life, that our actions make a difference. And we can make a difference that's beneficial. And so we're not just simply at the mercy of the winds of life, that whatever life brings us, that's going to affect how we feel and our happiness and our peace. But we have a very important role to play for our well-being, for our happiness, for our peace, for our spiritual well-being. And so that's part of the view of right view, that we can make a difference. I take that to be really good news. Life can seem chaotic, and it can be very hard sometimes to see the causal world we're in, cause and effect, and what affects what, and it's kind of because of the complexity of it all. And it's good to know that there is possibility to make a difference. And the whole Eightfold Path is a training to help us develop ourselves so that we can see, we can act most effectively around this particular teaching of right view, that our actions are consequential and we can choose to do the actions which are beneficial for us. And again, this involves a little bit of a purposeful life. There's being a nightstand Buddhist might only benefit you while you're reading the book in bed. But we have to, something's required of us to be on this path. And so we're required to do the things that bring us benefit. So as I was going to say, so the Eightfold Path is a whole program for doing that, because to really do it thoroughly and understand how to do it thoroughly takes a long time. It's not easy to understand the human mind, not really to understand ourselves and our response and reaction to the world. But if we can slow down, get calm, practice mindfulness, and really begin studying our lives carefully, then we start seeing the places of choice where we can make choices that are for our benefit rather than for our harm. So that's the first aspect of right view. And without some belief, some appreciation that your actions can have consequences, why would you act differently? The second aspect of right view is usually described from the point of view of the Four Noble Truths. And this is where suffering becomes noble. Again, not because we want to suffer more, but rather when we do suffer, we transform the suffering into something that's worthwhile to experience and understand deeply if we connect it to a path to freedom. If we understand the perspective that shows us where the freedom is found. And so one of the things we do is we stop for suffering. Suffering is not considered to be bad news when you're practicing. So if it happens during this retreat that you suffer, and generally people suffer a fair amount the first day, so I hope that's not the case, but if it's been a challenge to be here, you're tired and have a headache, and your body aches, and your mind has a mind of its own, it's hard to get it focused, and that's discouraging because you came here to be mindful and be present, and your mind, you know, is off somewhere else. All that's part of the first day of retreat. Often understood the first day of retreat can be difficult. And we encourage you, please don't take it personally. Don't succumb to points of view, interpretations of it, that just drag you down further. So hold it lightly. It's okay. But we meet our suffering, and then we get interested in it enough to begin looking at understanding what it arises out of. What's the source in which it comes from? And the source, the simple way that this Buddhist tradition wants to say, is it comes from compulsive desire, from craving, from thirst. That there's some kind of compulsion within us, compulsive desire, that has kind of a force behind it, an insistence behind it, that makes it hard for us to put it down. You can't just let go of it easily. And because it's so insistent, and it often, sometimes when it doesn't get what it wants, there's frustration, there's anger, there's discouragement, there's stress, there's strain, there's disappointment, there's feelings of dissatisfaction that arises. But if we can step back and really take into account, really see clearly the compulsion, the desire that's behind it, then we're in a different world. Then we can have a different relationship to it, because if we see it clearly, then we don't have to believe it as much. It's kind of like we step out of its force field, step out of its energy, and look back at it, and realize it's not me. It's not what has you know. It's not in charge of the show. There's more going on here than the desire. I think one of the most useful things is not to believe it. And so, a lot of the mindfulness, silence, the retreat, is to slow down enough, quiet enough, so we can start becoming more sensitive, more aware of the deeper underlying attitudes, beliefs that are held so tightly that they could be called compulsions, compulsive desires. We want, we think we need. So one of the things you can do, which especially here on the retreat, is if you find yourself experiencing suffering, you can ask yourself some questions. You can ask yourself, what is it that I think I need right now? What is it I think should happen right now? What is it that I want right now? What is it that I think shouldn't happen right now? What do I want? What do I not want? What am I afraid of? Because compulsive fear has a quality of desire in it, the same kind of this thirsting. So it's all these compulsions we have. And we want to flush them out to understand what they are. Because when we don't see them and they operate, they have a lot of power over us. But when we really see what they are, they begin to lose their power. And when we start losing their power, then we stop investing ourselves in them. We stop living under their authority. And when we stop investing our energy, our time, our beliefs, investing our confidence in some of these compulsions, then they can begin to have less force in our lives, and they can even cease, even fade away. And the fading away of compulsions is the third noble truth. And knowing there's a possibility of coming to the end of suffering, coming to the end of compulsion, is very encouraging. And because it's not so easy to do it, we have the Eightfold Path. And so these Four Noble Truths and Eightfold Path, they kind of go round and round together. The Four Noble Truths end with the Eightfold Path. The Eightfold Path begins with the Four Noble Truths. Because it's the framework, the perspective of the Four Noble Truths are very useful ones to have. They're probably more useful perspectives to bring to bear on a situation than the perspective, I'm bad, I'm a bad person. Or, if only everyone was quiet in the meditation hall, then I could really meditate, those people. Or, you know, they serve tofu today, and don't they understand that we're carnivores and should have served steak? If we had steak, then I really could have meditated well. And so kind of blame the world outside. But those kinds of blaming and looking outside or blaming ourselves does not support us for finding this beautiful, wonderful thing, the path to freedom. So I started off the talk with the idea of a sense of purpose. And connected to the sense of purpose is also a sense of confidence. Where do you put your confidence? Do you put confidence in your neurosis? Or do you put confidence in the path? And what we're hoping is that this kind of practice here will help give you confidence in mindfulness. Confidence in a perspective, not a belief. It's not like you have to adopt some belief, but rather a perspective that is useful for the purpose of becoming free. It's a pragmatic perspective. So, you know, if you cut your finger, a perspective that's useful is that it's good to keep it clean. You know, that's just a useful point of view. I don't know if you have to believe it. It's not like a metaphysical belief. So same thing with the Four Noble Truths. There are perspectives that are useful to adopt. And at any point, you know, Andrea talked about right here is where the path is, right? Pointing back here. It's not a journey to someplace, it's a journey to here. At any point in the journey of your life, you can step back on the path if you look at the situation you're in through the framework or the perspective of the Four Noble Truths. Is there in this situation something, a strain or a stress or something feels unsatisfactory or disappointment, discouragement, despair, anger, grief, fear, variety of things? What is the suffering here? Is there any? If there isn't, then relax. Enjoy. But is there, where is it? And then if you find that, where is the compulsion? Is there compulsion? Is there a desire? Is there belief? Is there a different point of view that you're operating on that is dragging you down? What is that point of view? And then can you look a little bit further? Can you open your vista wider and appreciate or intuit that yes, there is a possibility of not suffering. There is a world beyond that. There is a life beyond my particular world of suffering. There is an end to it and freedom from it. To be encouraged and buoyed and confident in this possibility, to be on this path that leads that. And this is why in the Buddhist tradition it's called a noble path, because it's considered to be one of the most noble things a person can do, is to come to the end of suffering, end of this kind of compulsively caused suffering. And as like the Dalai Lama keeps saying, one of the primary desires of all human beings is to be happy. One of the primary drives of compassion is to want to free people from their suffering. And so for Buddhists, this whole enterprise of understanding suffering, coming to the end of it, coming to happiness at the other side of it, is connected to the deepest or the most noble desires and purposes that we can have. There might not be any other more noble, from a Buddhist point of view, a more noble and valuable purpose than to understand suffering, its cause, to come to the end of it, to be free of it, and then to combine that with our compassion for ourselves and the world. So it does require, I don't know if it requires is exactly the right word, but a change of reference, a change of orientation from how we orient our life in the usual way. And I say that a little bit carefully because generally in the Western Buddhist world, we're very careful about not wanting to impose ideas and views on people. Like you have to be any different. Just accept yourself as you are. You can't, you know. But, you know, it's a little bit dangerous to say just accept yourself as you are because then you can just learn to suffer better. And, you know, that's not the point. But there is a kind of a change, a switch that is required to do this practice. And to maybe just, if you allow me to use the kind of language of the talk, we have to at least switch from mall mind to path mind. We have to switch from being focused on the external world and focused on building up the self and self-identity issues and conceit and trying to prove ourselves and measure ourselves against other people. And there's all these external beliefs and ideas that are not very helpful. And to make a switch to something that's more helpful. And if there's only one thing that you want to remember to do while you're here, and to try to do it as often as you can, is to make the switch to being mindful, being aware. But to be aware and mindful in a way that pulls you out of the strong currents of reactivity, the strong currents of interpretation that you have of what's going on, the strong currents of identification, me, myself, and mine that's happening. Come back to being aware. And it's not meant to be a really difficult thing to do. I just loved when Andrea said this morning about if you just kind of do half a breath, how easy it is, you know, half a breath. Certain little moments of awareness come so easily. If I clap my hand, I suppose it didn't take any effort on your part to hear the clap. You weren't expecting it, and boom, there it was there. That there's a certain kind of ease that can happen with being aware. What happens, what becomes a strain in mindfulness practice is one part of the strain is when we have all these shoulds and beliefs. I need to, I should, I'm a bad person if I don't, or I'll be a good person if I do, or I'm supposed to kind of bear down and so all these orientations we bring to being aware that makes it really heavy. It's so important. Gil said to live a purposeful life, and now I have to kind of, you know, tighten up and get serious. You know, and, you know, so then that's what takes effort. And so this movement of looking at the Four Noble Truths helps us to see, where is all this compulsion? How am I tightening up? How am I suffering because of how I'm practicing? Can I loosen up? Can the continuity of practice come not from bearing down or pushing, but can it somehow become from relaxing back into the simplicity of what some people might call natural awareness? You'll be aware. If you relax deeply and open up, you'll be aware. Keep coming back to being aware. See if your awareness can be more easeful. If you feel like you're not paying enough attention, your mind's wandering a lot, you might see if, rather than trying harder, don't try less exactly, but try in a different way. Try by relaxing into what's happening, or opening up into what's happening, rather than tightening up into what's happening. So, to walk this path requires a shift from business as usual to a different perspective, a different orientation. And that different orientation is called right view. It's one of the first wisdom factors of the path. And with the right view at hand, you'll find the path wherever you go. And you'll be on the path if you're seeing that way. And then once you're on the path, then the next step of the Eightfold Path is sometimes said in English to be right intention. The right approach for actually being on the path once you're on it. And that's the topic for tomorrow. So you have the path. The path is in you. I hope that you will engage with it in a purposeful way. Walk the path purposefully, but lightly. The lighter you can walk, probably the easier it'll be for you. If you carry a lot of baggage with you and backpacking, your suitcases and your refrigerator and all the important things you need to TV, you're not going to get very far down the trail. But if you can walk the trail, walk the path lightly, you can go quite far. Purposefully and lightly. May you hold it all lightly. And may you hold yourself lightly. One step at a time. It's the custom at these retreats sometimes, at the end of a talk, to take a couple of minutes to get kind of back into the more the mindfulness mode of sitting and being quiet and connected to yourself. So we'll take a couple of minutes to be quiet here.